This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything that Tom and myself have been up to on a Tuesday morning. That includes continuing the Business Breakfast Summer Book Club, hearing not just from business leaders about what they're packing this summer, a little bit of an insight into their personalities their book picks tend to give us, but also what's happening in the publishing world when it comes to the economics of actually getting a book out there. We've also been looking at the real estate market. Really interesting report coming out from the guys at Knight Frank about the lack of listings, not just in the prime market, but also in the residential market in Dubai as a whole. You cannot find a house to put up for sale. Faisal Durrani reckons that homes in general in Dubai, the listing of them has dropped by around a quarter over the last year. We've also been looking at flows from place to place, the flow of funding into the Middle East with Philip Bahoshi of Magnet, the flow of basketballs into the Coca-Cola Arena, exciting new tie-up, and the flow of UAE nationals and expats into Japan with the yen at a 34-year low. We've got a couple of big conversations going on this morning. One of them being whether or not cold calls are the nuisance they used to be. Only because we make less calls, we take less calls, do we still pick up the calls regardless?
Yeah, so double whammy this one. Obviously, yesterday we were having a look at reputation, industry reputation or industrial reputation here in the region. The Insight Discovery team had put together their annual list of the good, the bad and the ugly of industries and professions where reputation might have let them down. Guess what? Cold callers rating pretty high on the bad list, the naughty step this year. That got us thinking about the new cold calling regulations that were coming into place, or telemarketing, call it what you will at the moment. Damien Wright, senior lawyer, Clyde & Co's regulatory and investigations team was kind enough to give us a little bit more insight into those regulations this morning. He's been going through them with a fine tooth comb ahead of their implementation a little later on this year. So, started by asking Damo for an overview on this recent legislation.
Well, the recent legislation has significantly changed telemarketing practices in the country. It takes effect on the 27th of August this year, and it's designed to protect consumers from the deluge of unwanted marketing calls. It also ensures that businesses conduct their telemarketing in a transparent and ethical manner. Essentially, the goal of this legislation is to balance consumer privacy with business interests.
Great initiative. No one's going to argue with that one at the moment. Show me anybody that looks forward to a cold call coming through. The big question is, are they going to work?
I think they will work. It all comes down to enforcement. So, you know, us as consumers, we need to get our numbers registered. And when we still get those unwanted calls, we need to take the time to file a complaint with the TDRA. Because if the legislation is now there, it's about the enforcement. So we also need to actually just make the extra effort and assist the TDRA with what they're trying to achieve here.
Damien Wright, senior lawyer, Clyde & Co's regulatory and investigations team.
I've also been looking this morning at the business of publishing. For our Business Breakfast Summer Book Club, we've not only been speaking to business leaders about what they're reading this summer, but we've been speaking to those in the industry about what kind of spike in sales they see in the leading up to summer. Do we still go out and buy a couple of books to take away on holiday? This is Kira Jean. She's the founder and CEO of the publisher, The Dreamwork Collective.
So we usually see a 25% increase on romance. I mean, for us, we publish mostly female fiction, and our target audience are female readers. So with that, we do see around a 25% spike around the summertime and see that kind of increase.
Well, that's positive. What about the business of publishing itself? We've talked a lot over the last couple of years about the rising cost of living. What's happening to the cost of making a book?
Yeah, obviously it's affected our business as well, but I would say there's been an increase in people buying books, which is interesting to see. I think it's an affordable guilty pleasure on a weekend. It's not too costly to be able to afford a book. And we've seen an increase in book sales. And I think that's a global thing that's happening post-pandemic. The sales have kind of reached where they were pre-pandemic, which is great to see. And so for us, it's good news. I think as a publishing business, we're seeing that kind of increase, but also an increase in audiobooks. And I think one of the things that's driving that the most is BookTok.
One of the other things that's helping is Netflix series. The guys from the DreamWorks Collective were recently an invitee of the Venice International Film Festival because there's possibly an extra revenue stream for publishers and for authors there.
The Venice International Film Festival has this part of their program that's dedicated to book adaptations. And I think what I learned being there is that filmmakers and producers struggle to find content. You have streaming platforms that are pushing out so much content at such a fast rate that they need to be able to find original stories, and that's not easy. And so having those kind of markets where we're able to pitch our books to producers and filmmakers and they're able to access the kind of stories that we're telling is a match made in heaven in many ways.
As someone who's been paid by a television producer as well as a publisher on behalf of authors, we're very grateful for it. Kira Jean is the founder and CEO of the publisher The DreamWorks Collective. More this week from authors, those in the industry, and from business leaders in our regular guests on what they are reading this summer.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Economy's on the up across the Emirates at the moment. We got that latest number through from Ashman a bit earlier on. The news team are running with that one. Ashman economy thriving as business licenses, they're up about, 15%. Good news out of Ras Al Khaimah as well. The real estate market there seems to be booming. Ras Al Khaimah government expanding its stake in RAK properties to 34%. That was announced yesterday. And then no shortage of data coming out of the real estate market here in Dubai. Dubai Land Department's latest number showing that the Dubai real estate sector has recorded $3.9 billion worth of transactions last week alone. Two significant Palm Jumeirah apartments sold for over $20 million each. Property Finder out with their latest numbers as well, suggesting Dubai real estate transactions hitting a record $34 billion in Q2. Off-plan sales soaring 80%. So as I said, there is no shortage of evidence there suggesting that things are still continuing to do very well. And that is being backed up by the latest piece of research and the latest figures out of Knight Frank. The global property consultant have just published their latest numbers for Q2. And it makes for some interesting reading. Number of homes available for sale in Dubai's prime residential markets. We're talking the luxury and the ultra-luxury prime residential areas. Has in fact fallen by 47% over the last 12 months, according to the latest analysis from Knight Frank. What's driving this fall? Is this supply and demand issues? Is this to do with oversupply or overwhelming undersupply? Let's find out now from the head of research, MENA region, and partner at Knight Frank, Faisal Durrani, who's been kind enough to join us live on the line and live via Microsoft Teams this morning. Good morning, Faisal.
Morning, Tom.
So the supply of luxury homes in the city doesn't seem to be meeting the demand. Is that fair?
Yes, Tom, that is fair. I mean, the exceptional amount of demand that we see from international high net worth individuals is overwhelming the available supply in the city, and developers are struggling to keep pace. I mean, during the first half of this year, we had 190 homes selling for over $10 million, which matches what we saw in the first half last year. But that was something that took place in parallel with a 65.5% decline in the number of $10 million plus homes available for sale.
I mean, we've seen evidence of this courtesy of you and peers and colleagues as well. I mean, the 2024 Destination Dubai report that Knight Frank put together suggesting was that there was this continuing fixation of the world's the super rich, the UNHWIs out there as well, a fixation with Dubai. That seems set to continue?
It does indeed. I think there are many reasons why the global high net worth individual community has their sights fixed on Dubai. I think first and foremost, the fact that luxury real estate in Dubai remains relatively affordable compared to many other global gateway cities is what's working in Dubai's favor. I mean, even if we talk about the mainstream residential market today, you're still talking about average prices of about $400 per square foot, which is, again, significantly cheaper than many other cities. And when we think about Dubai's prime residential markets, which are Emirates Hills, the Palm Jumeirah, Jumeirah Bay Islands, and Jumeirah Islands collectively, about $1 million gets you about 980 square feet of real estate space in these four areas, which is about three or four times more than you'd expect to get in London, New York, or Singapore.
Let's talk about that prime market if we can, because as you mentioned, some of the most sought after keys and properties are in those aforementioned areas of the city. But given the supply and demand issue, is there any way that that prime market could expand in future years?
It could. So the way in which we define a prime residential area is a location where at least 10% of deals have taken place at more than 10 million dirhams. And that needs to have been sustained for three consecutive years to demonstrate an area is able to hold its value. And in fact, of the four areas I listed for you, Jumeirah Islands only qualified for prime status in Q1 this year. We are very closely monitoring every neighborhood in the city. And currently on our watch list, we've got Tilal Al Ghaf, Al Barari, and even Jumeirah Golf Estates. Now, these areas are on the cusp of qualifying for prime, but what is interesting about these locations is that they're all inland communities centered on green space. And you referenced our Destination Dubai report earlier, and what we have found is that global high net worth individuals, when considering where to invest in Dubai, are actively seeking locations that offer green space. That is their number one criteria when selecting a neighborhood in Dubai.
Talking of neighbourhoods, one neighbourhood that continues to rock, and I just mentioned at the beginning of those latest numbers last week from Dubai Land Department, Palm Jumeirah continuing to be a focus for so many. In fact, two Palm Jumeirah apartments sold for over $20 million mark last week alone. Palm Jumeirah, is that still not so much head and shoulders above other prime markets, but leading the charge?
It is indeed. The Palm Jumeirah remains at the center of demand for the global high net worth individual community. Villa prices on the Palm today are over 200% higher than they were back in the last market peak in 2017. So yes, it is very much at the center of attention for high net worth individuals because it offers what most of them are looking for, that Dubai lifestyle, which typically comes in the form of a standalone beachfront property. And where better to secure one of those than on the Palm Jumeirah?
And that was going to be part of my next question, okay, all good and well, but is this just the ability of ultra high net worth individuals to invest wherever they wish around the world and therefore seeing this as an investment tool? Or is it more than that? Is it the lifestyle? Is it this idea of putting down roots here in the region?
It is indeed. So the behavior of high net worth individuals in this third freehold residential market cycle in Dubai is quite different to what we've seen in the past. And this isn't just based on anecdotal evidence. We see that in the form of the falling level of listings in the city, which we've talked about. Even citywide, actually, I can exclusively reveal to you today that we've seen a 23% drop in the number of homes available for sale across Dubai as a whole, not just in our prime neighborhoods. And global high net worths now view Dubai as a second homes destination. They want to purchase real estate in Dubai for personal use, be it for a holiday home, a retirement home, or as I say, a second home. And we know this because we've seen high net worth individuals secure properties in locations like the Palm Jumeirah for record prices and then spend the same amount again on refurbishing some of these homes, very strongly indicating that they are buying them for personal reasons.
Faisal, really appreciate your time this morning. I know we're in different time zones at present, so thank you so much indeed for taking time to speak to us this morning. Faisal is partner, head of research at Knight Frank Mina. He's also just been explaining those latest numbers for us. Yeah, a lack of availability out there in the market. What pressure is that going to put on developers to build it? And they will come. They will come in their droves by the looks of things. We will have more on the real estate sector and its continued growth in the days to come.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Go spend, says Tom, and they are, with the yen at a 34-year low against the dollar. UAE tourists increasingly looking at Japan. We are very pleased to be joined by Takao Yamamoto, who's the Middle East representative for the Japan National Tourism Organization. Takao, it's lovely to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Brandy. Thank you for having me today.
So how many more of us are coming over? What kind of rise in visitors from the UAE have you seen?
So this last year, 2023, Japan welcomed more than 33,000 GCC nationals, which is almost 400% increase from the previous year, even like 17% increase from 2019 pre-pandemic.
Okay, so that's the Gulf. What about from here, from the UAE?
From the UAE, like last year, more than 10,000 visitors. Even like last month, May, we had a big soccer match, football match in Japan. So many UAE like supporters flew to Japan to support the airline.
So the lower yen's making Japan cheaper for them. How much cheaper?
Well, I remember maybe around 10 years ago, $1 was 80 yen. Now it's $1 is more than 160 yen. So it's a big discount. But, you know, Japan is not only for this reason that it's a great country to visit, and we'd like to talk about it.
How easy is it to get there, flights-wise, visa-wise?
Yes, you know, the flight connectivity is getting much better now. Japan Airlines just started a daily flight this March from Hamad International Doha to Japan Tokyo Haneda. But also Etihad Airways, they started Kansai Osaka five weekly flights to Osaka from Abu Dhabi. And Emirates, of course, Airbus 380 flights to Tokyo Narita and Kansai Osaka. And also they just started to announce that they will refurbish the new Airbus, Boeing 777 flights Tokyo Haneda.
So it gets cheaper. Does that change what we do when we're there? Do we see different activity as the result of a lower currency?
Actually, like, you know, I've seen like many people, if you visit Japan for the first time, it's like a Tokyo, Mount Fuji, Kyoto, Osaka by bullet train. We call this golden route. But I see more and more travelers exploring Japan like in different off-beaten tracks, or like some go to Hokkaido, Northern Island, or some go to Setoichi Inland Sea. There's many beautiful museums for art lovers. And also like nature, yeah.
It's not just us that are looking at Japan. Obviously, a lot of countries that work in the dollar are also seeing the savings there. Georgia on the agendas later is going to be talking about over-tourism concerns in Europe. Is there a downside to this? Is there a worry about over-tourism in Japan with so much interest?
I've heard that the news that, you know, coming from Kyoto, for example, there's a Gion district with Geiko and Maiko, you know, traditional Japanese entertainers. And many tourists just trying to kind of paparazzis, and they're bothering those girls. I think it's very important to just respect the local people, like, you know, the rules. And that's a small thing, but I think we need to respect that.
Is there concern on the ground, though, about the amount of people coming to Japan?
I don't think so. You know, we are capable to having more tourists, and the Japanese government set goal to receive more than 60 million visitors to Japan per year. I think currently like about 30 million kind of mark. And so like we have more than double to receive.
What's being put in place, though, to manage more people at some of the more popular sites? Are we seeing more ticketing, charges on attraction, a change in the amount of people who are let through at different times? Because you need different crowd management.
Yeah, of course. And like, you know, infrastructure-wise, like we have more and more new hotels opening in Japan. I've seen like in Kyoto especially, or Tokyo, we have more hotels. So I'd like you to come visit and explore these luxury hotels as well.
Do we see charges put on things that were previously free? Do we see limited numbers? Do people need to start booking the more popular areas to go in advance? What does it actually mean for your holiday?
I know this market, like, you know, it's more like last minute market. And but in Japan, especially like if you like to visit, like, you know, peak season, like cherry blossoms, I recommend that you book way advance to secure your holidays.
But you've got things like new fee trails on Mount Fuji. I mean, things are being put in place to manage the crowds.
Yes, like Mount Fuji also, it's a bit over tourism. You need to book secure your entrance, and I think you need to get the permit to enter Mount Fuji these days.
Yeah, it is. And it's, like I said, new trail fees to make sure that we don't get overcrowding there. Before we let you go, the other great thing that's happening in Japan that will attract the visitors is Expo 2025.
That's right, yes.
How many people are you expecting to come for it?
Not like, I don't think it's as big as like Dubai ones, but I think it's more than 20 million visitors we expect. I think like more than 10% should be coming from overseas.
And from this region, interest?
I know there's much more interest in this region for Expo, like, you know, since last time it was 2020 in Dubai, and also 2030 is happening in Riyadh. So I've seen like many people are interested in coming to visit Japan for this reason.
Because we understand now what an Expo is. Thank you so much for joining us. Takao Yamamoto is the Middle East representative of the Japan National Tourism Organization. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk funding here in the region if we can. Magnet, the leading venture capital data platform for emerging venture markets, have just published, and I say just published, because it comes out today, the H1 2024 VC investment summary. What that be? Basically, comprehensive report focusing on venture capital investments into tech startups across the emerging venture markets here and further afield. To allow us to tell us more about the findings here, because obviously a lot of focus on VC funding levels across a number of markets. It'd be interesting to see how the MENA region is faring at the moment. Phil Bahoshi is the founder and the CEO of Magnet. He joins us live here in studio this morning with that report hot off the press. Morning to you, Phil. Good to have you on board.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
So, I mean, just from a... from a macro sort of point of view, where are we at with VC funding levels across markets at the moment?
Yeah, so we have to put everything in context of the global venture capital space. If you look at global venture, after what was record highs in 2020 and 21, we've seen a straight line decline in the total number of transactions up until basically this year. In terms of funding, we're seeing what I call a plateauing. We're seeing this inflection point. I think we're bottoming out in terms of venture. And we always look at the US or global trends because it's a good indicator of what's happening in emerging markets, because they tend to be one or two quarters lagged. And effectively, what we've seen in the report that we've just published is that exactly that. We're at the beginning of the plateauing for venture capital off the back of this extreme liquidity in 2020 and 21, and a new norm of what's happening. But most interestingly, the levels that we're seeing now, both globally and here, are very much in line with the levels we saw pre-pandemic, which at the time were record levels of funding. So the positive is that we haven't gone lower than that, but we are reaching the bottom and likely to start seeing an inflection towards a positive return.
And is that across all the markets that you track as well, or are there sort of anomalies along the line?
So I think on aggregate, yes, it's very similar, but the MENA region has fared better than potentially Africa or Southeast Asia, largely driven by the GCC and specifically Saudi Arabia and the UAE that have actually weathered the storm somewhat better than many other geographies. But the reality is, trend-wise, they're very similar in terms of patterns.
Talking of those MENA numbers as well, and we all get wrapped up in what's going on in the MENA region. We've just been talking about how busy it is during summer, etc., off air there at the moment as well. Can you put your finger on to why the MENA is doing better in this space than other markets that you're tracking at the moment?
I think number one, when you specifically focus on the UAE and Saudi Arabia, there is a concerted government effort with policies to drive innovation and technology. The second thing is, in both of those jurisdictions, you have fund of funds, effectively sovereign entities that deploy capital into VCs that can then translate into investments into startups. So both of those, from a policy perspective, as well as from a capital perspective, have supported the ecosystem. As well as being two of the most attractive markets here in the MENA region, many companies are looking to relocate here from outside of the GCC to be able to raise capital. The most interesting stat, for instance, is that non-mega deal funding, deals which are $100 million plus, have actually grown in MENA and specifically in Saudi. That's a sign that the underlying funnel of the ecosystem continues to develop.
We've just been talking to the team from Knight Frank. They were talking about the undersupply of the prime residential areas for ultra high net worth individuals who are coming to town as well. That would suggest a migration of wealth into country, into market, into region. Is that also equating to investment into markets here at the moment with this wealth coming in, or is it completely separate?
I think there's a parallel. I can't directly correlate them. What we did see from this report, for instance, was a 30% increase in the total number of investors investing in the MENA region. Now, that's predominantly been at early stage, but there have been signs that there are more investor institutions investing in startups. Now, interestingly, those sovereigns that I referred to that fund VCs have also attracted international VCs to the region. We've seen the likes of Antler, General Atlantic, and many other names. There's been a 130% increase in the announcement of new funds. The problem is that that takes time to actually get into the system. So from a positive perspective, exactly what you're saying, they've made it more attractive and attracted international investors. That translating into dollars takes a little bit of time.
You've noted the positives, and there are positives. You're quite right, and you highlight that in the report as well. Are there, I don't like to use the N-word, negative, but let's, are there concerns?
Well, I mean, effectively, venture is still down. So relative to years gone by, the ability to raise capital is still hard. The second thing is when you look at exits, we talk about in the region the need for liquidity. And effectively, that comes through exits, IPOs. We're still seeing that exit activity, M&A activity, is still down relative to many years gone by. And for us to see a return of investor appetite and risk appetite, we have to see that return of exit activity happening. But from a positive perspective, that also takes time. And valuations have come down back to levels of 2018-19, making it both attractive for investors and potential acquirers in the region.
Positives to be taken out of the MENA region, positives to be taken out of the data that you're collating. Although you did say at the beginning, you know, the global trend of declining venture investments is a concern for many. Is that something that is keeping you awake at night or not?
I think what keeps me awake at night is understanding what is going to be done to get ourselves in the best position coming out of this. And again, the region is probably in its second decade of evolution. And a lot of work and effort was done from private and public sectors to kind of develop this startup and venture ecosystem. The challenge becomes when venture starts going down, some of the cracks begin to reveal themselves. And it's now where you need to double down in investment, policy, development of the ecosystem so that we're in a very strong position coming off the back of it. And that's really what we try to highlight through the report, not just the positives. I think I've been on the show several times over the last couple of quarters, and I've been somewhat more cautious than I have been this time. I think what the signs are is that we're seeing the bottoming out and that the positivity is beginning to come into the ecosystem. And if you look at global venture and global economic and political situations, you start seeing that if interest rates start coming down, if we see the interesting situation in the elections in the US and Europe come to fruition, then there is more positivity to come into the market in the next couple of quarters.
You've laid it out for us in H1, the first half of 2024. From what you're seeing from the data you've been able to collate, is it suggesting more of the same for the second half of the year?
So specifically in MENA, what we've tracked, according to Magnet, is that Q3 tends to be the slowest quarter. So the summer, where people are away, isn't the most fertile for investment announcements and activity. Having said that, Q4 tends to be always the record high. For the last 2 years, it's always been the highest quarter of investment activity. And H2, on average, tends to be better than H1 in terms of venture. So from that perspective, it's positive. And again, when you look at the global trends, according to the global reports that have been published, it was the first three-quarter incline of funding that we've seen in 3 years. If we mirror that here in the region, then we're likely to see more positivity returning in the venture spends, hence the inflection point.
Phil, can't thank you enough. Thanks so much indeed, A, for the numbers, B, for popping in and saying hi as well this morning. Have yourself a lovely summer.
Thank you very
and
much.
And we will catch up in Q3 and Q4. You can guarantee that, Phil Bahoshi. It's the founder and the CEO of Magnet.
The Business Breakfast Summer Book Club.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yeah, a bit of it. We're calling it a tradition. It's the second year that we've done this. Asking business leaders what they are going to be reading on their holidays. We've had such a great response this year that we are running it all week. And we also want to hear from you, what you are reading. The first that we're going to hear from this morning is actually the governor of where I am sitting now. I guess technically he's our landlord because he looks after Internet City, Media City and a lot of other areas as the Executive Vice President of Commercial Leasing at the TECOM Group, Emma Al-Malik.
This summer, inshallah, I plan to read two books, the first of which is Nassim Taleb's Skin in the Game. I've heard a lot about this author and this book. I'm eager to dive into his thoughts on risk, decision-making, and other ideas. It's going to be my first book by Nassim, by the way, and I am quite excited. The second book is by Marcus Aurelius, and it's Meditations. It is a reread. This is a book that offers, you know, bigger picture on life, helping us take a step back, reflect on things that actually matter. It's a book that you can take to your time with. If you do get a chance to read it, I highly do recommend it.
And Emma Al-Malik, the Executive Vice President of Commercial Leasing at TECOM Group, including where we're sitting now, Internet City, Media City. We've also been chatting to Sharif Al-Badawi. Now, he's the CEO of the Dubai Future District Fund. Fittingly, in his book pick for the summer, he's looking at how to get a longer future.
So the book I am very excited to read over the next few weeks this summer is called Outlive. It's a book by Dr. Peter Attia. He's was a renowned surgeon who left the career to focus on longevity and lifespan, and more specifically, health span. And the book is one of the primary books that everyone who's in that field right now and the trend that's happening around longevity and healthcare uses as a sort of baseline information. I mean, just the first couple chapters, it's great in the way he does the storytelling and distills, you know, the very technical scientific stuff for anybody to understand. I'm very excited to get to the end of it and hopefully start to follow some of the practices.
Sharif Al-Badawi, the CEO of the Dubai Future District Fund. Someone else who's been in touch with us about what they're planning to read this summer is a familiar voice on the radio and indeed around Dubai in general, the restaurant boss Naeem Madad. He's the chief executive of Gates Hospitality. And this summer, he's packed not one, but two non-fiction books in his suitcase.
The two books that I'm stashing away in my suitcase this year are, the first one is called Mindset by Carol Dweck. It's a psychology of success, and I believe in the world we're living in today, we all need to be reminded how powerful our minds are, and a bit of a read and information will always help me revive my inner intuition. The second book is called Never Eat Alone by Keith Ferrazzi. It's really a networking and a relationship building book. It's a hype and a motivator. That's me for this summer.
Yeah, restaurant boss tells people never to eat alone. Bit of on-brand recommendation there for Naeem Madad. And of course, if people aren't eating alone, that's extra covers in your restaurant. We've also been speaking to a couple of economists about what they will be packing. One of those is Simon Williams. He's the chief economist at HSBC. He's reading good fiction and some non-fiction this summer.
I'm back reading William Boyd and have a new copy of Any Human Heart ready to go because life's not a destination, and it's all about the ripples we send to the shore. Guilty Pleasure. There's a new Robert Harris book coming out during the last week. I'm on vacation. I should know better, but I don't. And I'll be downloading it as soon as it comes out because he writes a great thriller. Non-fiction. I've got a copy of A Primate's Memoirs by Dr. Robert Sapolsky. He's a neuroscientist who spent every summer for 25 years observing the same group of baboons in East Africa. The book is about the monkeys and their behavior, which makes it about us and ours. And I'm hoping it's as readable as this book on free will and just as unsettling.
Love Richard Harris. It's a bonding point between me and my dad. It's the author we have in common. He wrote Pompeii. I'm going to be not a million miles away from there this summer. The other economist we've been speaking to is Khatija Haque, Chief Economist at Emirates NBD, being very honest and realistic about her summer reading habits.
I fully intend to be reading Chick Lit on the beach next week, but my proper reading list for the summer includes a book called Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. I think given in the context of the politics and the political change that we're seeing around the world at this time, this book makes the case that if people assume that humans are intrinsically good, it actually leads to better political and economic outcomes. So I think that's a positive message to be taking on board at this time when there seems to be a huge amount of uncertainty about the way that the world is moving.
Khatija Haque. And interesting that she has fessed up there to liking Chick Lit. Everyone's naming some very highfalutin books this summer.
Yeah.
You're not having it?
I'm not having it. In fact, I want a summer book club follow-up, all right?
In which we quiz people on their books.
After the summer, to quiz them on the books. I want to hear those Marcus Aurelius quotes. I want to hear the findings of all the others, and that's not me having a dig at anybody in particular. I think we all go away with best intentions of, you know, we all pack a couple of books and we all have got best intentions of using our times accordingly and reading a lot over, and we just end up, you know, flicking through our phone and reading the right hand column on the Daily Mail. That's it.
Well, it's funny that Khatija has said Chick Lit, so effectively romance, and the two book industry insiders that we've had in the studio, the guys from Bookworld yesterday and the publisher that we had in this morning, have both said what sells in the lead up to summer? Romance. 25% spike, the guys from the Dream Collective, who are a local publisher, said this morning. That's what they see the spike in coming into summer. The bookseller yesterday said exactly the same. There's one book that two people nominated last year and a couple of people have nominated this year. And I don't just know what it says about the people they work with, but one of the people who's nominated it this year is the gold expert, Jeff Rhodes.
A book called Surrounded by Idiots caught my eye this time last year that I found to be a fascinating insight into human behaviour, particularly in the business space. And I have to say that this has helped me to deal with the stresses associated with gold's record-breaking run this year. It hasn't all been plain sailing, far from it. Thomas Erickson was the author, and he has produced a follow-up called Surrounded by Setbacks that promises to tell us how to deal with any curveballs that might be coming our way, either from a business or personal perspective. I look forward to telling you all about it. Happy reading.
Yeah, Jeff Rhodes, there's always a couple of nominations every year for Surrounded by Idiots.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, let's continue the conversation on all things sport as we look to slam dunk our way into the world of basketball.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. I keep it so fresh on the microphone. I like no interruption when the game is on. I like slam dunk to take me to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like the pick and roll. I like the give and go. And it's basketball. Bow wow, let's go.
Well, there we go. Thank you, DJ Bow Wow, for that one. Why are we talking all things basketball? Well, massive news coming out yesterday from Dubai Basketball and Coca-Cola Arena. Newly established sports franchise team Dubai Basketball announcing yesterday an exclusive partnership with the Coca-Cola Arena, as part of which the arena will be the home venue of the team. in itself. It's a milestone agreement, heralding Dubai's first sports franchise team to be the official anchor tenant of the Coca-Cola Arena. Let's welcome the president of Dubai Basketball, who has joined us live here in studio. Salim bin Dasmal is with us here this morning on the Business Breakfast. Salim, great to see you as always.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to us about this deal first and foremost. We've got a lot to unpick here, but how important was it to get a home venue?
Terribly. First of all, let me just say thank you for having me. Thrilled and excited to be playing at the Coca-Cola Arena. It's a perfect venue for us. I just also want to take a moment to extend my gratitude to Dubai Holding. They made a significant investment in the Coca-Cola Arena to make it, to prepare it essentially for international basketball. So they had to acquire the floor, acquire the hoops, install a new jumbotron, make upgrades to the lighting and audio infrastructure, all key elements to allow us to host international level basketball games. I also want to make a special mention and gratitude as well to Dubai Media Office for their assistance as well in promoting Dubai basketball. I just want to say or mention that this is has been a brainchild of Abdullah Saeed Al-Nabuda. He is the chairman and the founder of Dubai Basketball Club. And him and Dayan, who was with me today, the GM of the club, has been with Abdullah from the very beginning of this this journey. Just getting into the plan for what we plan to do as a basketball team, a professional basketball team, is play the ABBA League. Now, the ABBA League is a high-tier or top-tier European league. It's it combines all the countries of the ex-Yugoslavia. Included in that is Serbia and Slovenia. You will know that, or you might recall that Jokic, or Jokic rather, is a three-time MVP player in NBA, in the NBA. He's Serbian. And Doncic was this year's NBA finalist. He represented the Dallas Mavericks. He's from Slovenia. So these are example of the talent that the ABBA League produces. We aspire to play the EuroLeague and the EuroCup, which are, is considered the top-notch league in Europe. Incidentally, we got invited to the EuroCup this year, but we had to regrettably decline. The main reason is we wanted to cut our teeth on the ABBA League this year before we accepted such a high-tier tournament. But we do plan to play that next year and then the EuroLeague in the years to come. So the Coca-Cola Arena will be our home venue, which is awesome. We're really excited. And this will allow us to play 15 games at home. The season extends from September to May. So 15 games at home, 15 games away in the countries that I mentioned. And what I'd also like to mention is, of course, it's a basketball game, but it's not just a basketball game for us, okay? There will be, of course, a high-level basketball game for the enthusiasts, but it's really a day out for the family. You're looking at pre-game activations, as well as game day activations, i.e., during the match. So, examples of pre-game activations will activate the area around the Coca-Cola Arena. We'll have food, retail, hoops for pickup games, and shooting competitions. And then during the game, we'll have activations during the intermissions, like competitions. And then we'll have fun things like t-shirt cannon shooters, for example, during the breaks, short breaks. So basically, it's a 5 to 6 hour day of full activities and entertainment, plus a high level basketball game.
And when the teams come to visit Dubai as well for their away games, your home games, that's when the activations will kick in for the fans, I take it.
Yeah. So during the home games, you're going to have about 2 to 3 hours prior to the game where families can come out and enjoy the activation. There'll be retail, there'll be food, there'll be hoops, like I mentioned. for competition. And then there'll be the game itself, which extends to about 3 hours. I'd like to also just take a moment to point out that this project came about through really was driven by data. Basketball is actually the second most viewed sport after football or soccer. And then we did a survey with interesting results. When asked, people in Dubai said they were missing a sports franchise. So we've created for the first time a professional sports team Dubai can call its home team. Now, this is very common everywhere in the world, but it's very uncommon in our part of the world. And we've created it for the first time. We've also created a pathway for the youth to become professional basketball players. Incidentally, we have a youth academy that's 10 years old. We have 600 kids in it, and we play or we run the academy at about half a dozen schools. We've also become a member. We're in the process, but we will be becoming a member very shortly in the UAE Basketball Association. This is important because it allows us to play domestically. In the domestic league, you're allowed 4 professional foreign players. The rest have to be local. So yeah. we will have a second team along with our pro team that can play in the domestic league. And that will allow the youth a pathway through the domestic league all the way through the potential for playing professionally at the highest
level. So you'll be developing the game here as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've got about a minute left with this one. Just in terms of some of the details. So September this year is when we can see the first game, expecting the first game set to start September 2024, your participation in the ABA League. Team announcement, franchise announcement. When can we expect that?
So we've been putting the team together. We already have the head coach and the assistant coaches and the conditioning coaches. We've signed 9 players out of the 12 player roster.
Yeah.
We play our first game on the 22nd against the champs of ABA League, okay, called Red Star.
Yeah.
And what we're creating here is a blueprint. The franchise that we're creating here is a blueprint for bigger things to come. I'll share that with you at another date.
Well, perfect. We will get you back in. Listen, I know you're hitting the floor running at the moment. I know it's busy times. We're out of time on this occasion, but can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing the big announcement. All the best at your new home from home, the Coca-Cola Arena. A big thank you to you for joining us live in studio. Selim Bin Dasmal, President of Dubai Basketball.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.